Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Bonna Pfeiffer.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for the needlework artist. And our artist this week, Leanne Van Leyen of 1897 Schoolhouse Samplers. Hi, Leanne.
Good morning, Gary and Bonna.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
Yeah, we're going to learn about the needlework, but boy, your personal life, I gotta know, you got things happening here, so this is going to be fun. your job alone is worth an hour, so we'll take that. And this show sponsored by the Attic Needlework in Mesa, Arizona, so we appreciate that, Gene Lee and company. And as we have said in the past, you know, if you're in Phoenix, you got to go. If you got a long layover in Phoenix, get in a cab and go to the Attic. Go see them. That shop is half museum and half needlework shop. So you can go in there and spend hours just looking at samplers. And I dare you to walk out of there without spending money. Yep. What is that they say about going to Costco? It's impossible to walk out without spending $200. Yeah, I think that's what they say. Yeah, this could be the Costco in terms of you can't go out without spending money. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. I love going there. And then I'll be there in Phoenix for 3 weeks in January. And one of the things we're going to do is men's night at the Attic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So sorry, Vonna, you're out.
I know. That stinks.
Yeah. Yeah, apparently there's several male type stitchers in the area, and so we're gonna get together in an evening, and Gene Lee and the guys, and we're gonna do some stitching and chatting, and alcohol may be involved.
Mm-hmm. Oh my!
It may be a couple of six packs of the brewskis may show up. You just never know. Yeah, so looking forward to that. That's gonna be fun, and then. This is a nice one from Lindsay Lane Designs. The December sampler of the month at the Attic is, and I'll completely butcher this. So if you're French, don't be offended. Pour to fête. Pourtafette.
I imagine that probably Leanne could help us with that.
Can you spell that again?
Pour. T-A and then F-E-T-E.
Oh, pour ta fête.
Well, see, I was close, Vonna. There.
You.
I have to admit my French isn't perfect, but I would say that's for the celebration.
Yep. Well, Gene said for your party, so there we go. Yeah, for the celebration, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because bonne fête is happy birthday.
Huh. And it's, okay, so Gary... Correct me if I'm wrong. Explain.
Oh, I will.
I know you will. Isn't it just a bunch of, is it alphabets?
Yeah.
It's alphabets and like border, it's border corner patterns too. Could that be a monochrome?
Yeah, you know, it could.
From the picture?
You know, it could. Yeah. First thing I saw it is I was going to take pieces and put them on a band sampler, on a banding.
Mm.
But
I was thinking, wouldn't that be I think a monochrome would be beautiful with that.
Yep. But yeah, it's a French sampler, 713 by 318 stitches. That's the December sampler of the month at the Attic. Pour to fête. 713
by
318.
Holy smack.
That's like your size.
713? No.
Was that too big for you?
Sarah Brazier is like... Sarah B, sorry, 482 by 482, 713.
Oh. So that's a long, long.
That's way. Long.
Well, I'm getting it anyway. I don't care.
Well,
how's
I don't
that?
Have anything to say about that. That's good. That's okay.
Yep. When I'm out there in January at the Attic, I'm getting it. Actually, I already told Gene, put one together for me. Yep.
Mm.
No, I think some of this stuff on banding would be pretty cool.
Yeah, it would be.
Mm-hmm. And you're right, a monochrome on this would be great.
Yep.
Very different.
That's what I thought.
Yep.
Yeah.
Lindsay Lane Designs, Pour to Fête, is the December sampler of the month at the Attic. And yeah, just go. And the, you know, you'll go to the Attic website and there ain't nothing there. But what's there is a link to the newsletters, and that's how you interact with the attic, is you get on the newsletter list, and you get the newsletter, and every month you get to drool over that, because it's multiple pages of photos and stuff that they have, samplers and other needlework designs that they have there. That's the thing to get, and that'll keep you up to date.
Then you pick up a phone and call.
Just any phone or your own phone?
Well, your own phone would be good, but it really doesn't matter. As long as you have a phone number and you know your name and have a credit card number, you can call them.
Yep. They will fix you up.
They sure will.
Yep. And, so there you have it. Thanks, Gene. Thanks to the folks at the Attic for sponsoring the show and causing me to spend more money.
Yeah.
Do you thank people for causing you to spend more money?
Oh, yeah, that's okay. Good, you know, surround yourself with good stuff.
Okay.
That's what I do.
Marketing by Vanna. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, Leanne. This was a left turn for me, because usually when I start to put together things for one of these shows, it's all about the sampling or the stitching career and all the things the designers have done and so on and so forth. But your day job. Wow. How do we end up doing that?
How did I end up here? I think I would say it's my grandparents' fault.
Okay.
And that's because
as long as there's a place to blame, that's good.
Well, I'm not blaming them. Believe me, it's all the credit, because this has been my dream job for my entire life almost. They took me there when I was 3 years old. I went to, and what we're talking about is Upper Canada Village. It's a world-class living history museum located on the St. Lawrence. Talking about interpreting life on the eve of our Confederation when we became a country in 1866. So if I go back to those formative years with my grandparents and coming in public school and then eventually getting married and taking my husband, it's been kind of a red line through my life that it's always been, I want to work here. And then a couple of years ago, well, it happened.
Okay. So this is full metal. This is all just as it was back then.
As much as we possibly can. Yes, there are some accommodations to what we do. They are very small, but for the public that walks through our doors on a daily basis, all of the people who are in costume, the last time I had numbers from my managers, there's about 100 of us. We aren't necessarily on site every day, but we do everything that we can to allow you to walk back in time, even if you still have your cell phone and taking pictures of us.
And so your title is Historical Domestic Interpreter.
And I'm also, you add to that, Historic Cook.
Oh, okay. So you do the costumes, the look, and then just reading about the cooking alone, you're cooking over open fire and... Mm-hmm. Wow.
There's three locations. Two I cook over an open hearth, and one I cook over a cook stove that was made in the 1870s. And I interpret period cooking, and I have to do the research myself, as well as from the more seasoned interpreters. I'm part of a team, so I don't operate in isolation. And I work with a very talented group that has helped me in terms of getting started with my research. But part of my job is very much about understanding period cookery, period implements, the lifestyle, the history, and then being able to bring that to life while you walk in front of me and maybe stand and talk to me for 2 minutes, or you could stand, and sometimes I have people in my building for an hour.
Hmm. Now, do you prepare?
And yes, I have to cook at the same time.
and you prepare a full meal? How does that?
So what happens is I will cycle in and out of three buildings, and two buildings, which we call the summer kitchen at the Louts Farmhouse. It's a family of United Empire loyalists that came up from central New York. I will interpret food in that building, and we do a meal or a tea every other day but Friday. We do the same thing in a place called the Tennant Farm, which really tells the story of emigration to Canada, coming mostly from the British Isles. And also, so the day that I am doing a meal at one of those locations, so at the summer kitchen, the other place is having a tea. So that's 12 and 3 o'clock. And then the next day you switch. And then on Fridays, we do a meal at our Cook's Tavern, which really explores taverns and transportation and the changing environment of transportation in Upper Canada, from stagecoaches and horses to having a Grand Trunk Railway. So there's a lot of different things that come into that in terms of the types of things that you cook and the role that you play within those particular buildings.
The Grand Trunk Railroad. My grandpa, his entire career on the Grand Trunk Railroad. Yep, I know that one. Yeah, these are all in authentic buildings too, I assume.
Yes, the majority of our buildings do come from our area, because in the 1950s, 1960s, your country and mine cooperated on the improvement of the St. Lawrence Seaway, and it ended up that a lot of communities were flooded and those buildings had to be moved. And there's a whole story that's behind that that I could tell you in another discussion. But the point being that some of those houses and artifacts were saved through a process, and they ended up creating Upper Canada Village. And it's been there just coming up on 60 years now.
I mean, I know there are these kinds of operations in the States, but that's pretty neat. And you get to so you do that, what, 9 months of the year?
We're May to September, and then I go back, but I'm not in costume over the Christmas season. We have some night programming that we go into called First Pumpkin Inferno, and then a light at night. So those are night-based programs where people don't go into our buildings. We don't have historical costumed interpreters. It's more of an outdoor experience. So I go back for the Christmas season for about a month, and then for the rest of the winter from January through until the beginning of May. At least not there.
Yeah. I love the way you go into presenter voice.
I apologize. That is just a habit formed of many hours of discussing.
No, you immediately went into presenter voice. It was excellent.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
And then what caught my eye is you also teach cross stitching, or at least demonstrate it at this village.
We do. So there's two different things that can happen, is that we talk about history and then we demonstrate it, and then we may also teach it. So the talking is what I'm doing with you now. The demonstration I will do whether I'm cooking or I'm sitting in, say, the front room of a building and I have a handwork project. And part of me getting this job is being able to do a wide range of handwork projects. So that's a different conversation, but I will interpret those. And then we also have children's programming as part of our curriculum here in Ontario. It involves the history of the country in Ontario, and those children come at particular times. So we will get a wealth of school groups coming in busload by busload up until the end of the school year at the end of June. And then in the summer months, so at the end of June through until begin of September, children will come and stay with us, whether for a weekend or a week. And then those children will either come and I will teach them how to cook, and they will actually cook with me on an open hearth or the wood stove. Or at this point, I'm teaching cross stitch. But at any time, I could be asked to teach any of the other skills that I have or the skills that I continue to develop.
Wow, that sounds like fun. You're not bored at all doing this then. That's great.
No, like I said, this is an absolute dream job. I've spent the last 2 or 3 years just, well, 2 years, I guess now, just pinching myself and saying this is actually happening. I'm actually doing this. It's just amazing.
Now what, when you're doing the cross stitch, what magnifier LED light do you use? No.
Well,
That would be
I don't have.
so funny. Just break one out.
We couldn't, but the straight answer to your question was there were bifocals in the time. So the glasses that I'm provided by my employer, I actually get glasses. They are multifocals.
Okay.
So there is a certain amount of magnification there, but I just take them off. But yes, that does give people a double take when you're in 1866 and then all of a sudden something is there that doesn't quite fit. That
Yeah.
will definitely take.
That'd be fun. I'd do that one time just for the entertainment. Yep. So where, how do you get involved in the stitching? What is the background there?
I've been thinking of that question, and stitching for me is not stitching alone. It's within a continuum. I've been around art and craft my entire life, and you know, if you put it in that context, working with my hands was always something I did, teaching myself crafts. Like when I was a child, I went to Upper Canada Village. I came home and decided I was going to dye fabric with a particular berry from outside and found out just what kind of bugs are in it. But the point being is that, believe me, I don't like sumac any longer. I won't bore you with the details of the bugs, but I still have visions of them. But it's something that I've always done. And I guess I picked it up when I was a child first through embroidery. I was taught in public school. And then my high school art teacher, who I spent every moment I could in the art portable at high school, had a cross-stitch project. And I didn't even think of it at the time. I just saw it and thought, oh, that's neat. And then I taught myself how to cross-stitch when I was in college. And now looking back, I know that Miss Torney, what she was working on was a Teresa Wensler, but I had no clue about it at the time because no one else I knew was stitching. Oh. So it just kind of came about. And then I was in college and I found out there was this shop and it was called the Cross Stitch Cupboard. And I ended up there and I ended up picking something up. And I thought, hey, you know what? I have long hours working with children. I'm going to take this with me when those children are sleeping and I'm doing an overnight. And then I'm going to teach myself. And it just, it's blossomed from there.
But that one exposure in school stuck with you.
It did. It did.
Yeah. See, that's important. You know, that's just so important that all those things in school that get lopped out, they pay off down the road if they're there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So then you took that. So you took that and grew it. And did you work at a needlework shop or how did you expand your stitching?
I think it wasn't a straight path. I taught myself how to stitch when I was in college. I got into Elizabeth Bradley kits, so woolwork kits. And then I kind of set that aside. And then at some point I found Blackbird Designs and I started stitching them. And then it went on from there to finding antique samplers and creating in a community. And it just ended up where it is right now. It's just been this whole journey of just following and finding.
Yeah. When did the samplers get into the mix here? Collecting samplers is not something everyone does. When did that little addiction start?
Addiction is the right word. My husband would very much agree with you on that one. So I think if I go back and I go back to teaching myself how to cross stitch and then getting into Elizabeth Bradley, and I started to see on eBay, I wasn't buying at the time, but it was more this interest of where does this Berlin woolwork patterns come from? How did this proliferation of patterns come about that people could use these to stitch in wool? I started to see samplers. And then I almost exclusively, when I was stitching for myself, I stitched Blackbird Designs patterns. And it just came about that I started to see these other patterns and I started to see, for want of a better way of putting it, patterns in the reproductions I was seeing by other designers. And all of a sudden it was like, wow, these are so beautiful. And at first it was something that was just outside of my reach. I was only seeing those perfect samplers for thousands of dollars. And then all of a sudden it became, and it just became an addiction.
Yeah. Obviously you have a historical orientation. I mean, your dream job is history. Is that part of what draws you to these things? Is a love of history?
It is. It's a love of history. It's also a love of women's lives and women's work. You know, if I go back through my life and I go back to a time when I was in high school and I took a fine arts course, and I took every opportunity I could to study art. And then I went to this specialized program. It took me 6 hours a day to get there. And to get home, one of the things that we studied was the history of art. So it was always the stories related to history, not necessarily the dates. It's, you know, what was life like? What were the conditions at that time? What were the influencing factors? How did things develop over time? And that same interest is what brings me to stitching and what brings me to my samplers. It's imagining a sampler that I have done in silk work, probably maybe 50, 60 stitches to an inch, of a little girl who did it when she was 8 years old, of imagining the conditions she must have been stitching in, and how could she have ever afforded those materials? What were the conditions around her? So that's kind of what brings me to it. And that's been a line through my life, whether it's been in fine art, it's been in stitching, it's been in visiting very many living history museums and museums in Canada and the US, and traveling very specifically to places to learn about kind of the broader perspective of life and what it really was in terms of the experience lived.
Oh, your husband. He's got to be, he's got to be an amazing man.
He is. He definitely shares the interest in the living history. I think at, you know, at times he kind of, do we have to go to another one? Can we just go to a car show for a change? Or can we go for a walk? But he is very long suffering. Yes, he is.
Yeah. Well, he needs to meet Vanna's husband then.
Oh.
Yeah, because they Vanna's husband, boy, I tell you, he does a lot. Yep. So that what was the first sampler you bought?
Oh goodness. I have to think back to her. It was one that talked about depending on your finger ends instead of your friends. And I can't remember the whole verse, but it was just so, it was funny, but it was also one of those things that you need to learn to depend on yourself and develop your skill. And it was just so cute. And it also had a couple colors that I just realistically I hated, but I loved, because it was just that little bit of, yeah. And it was probably 5 years ago, I would say, maybe seven.
Would you find it in an antique shop?
No, I found that one and many more on eBay.
Okay.
and usually from the same seller. She has some beautiful, beautiful stuff, and lovely stuff.
That can be a real time consumer, I'm imagining, going through online looking for samplers.
It is. It in itself is an addiction in terms of the thrill of the hunt, and not only online, but also now taking it out and trying to find ones within the community and other sources. Yes, it takes on a life of its own.
Yeah, I can see that happening. Yeah. I was wondering, as I was getting things together, are there little girl samplers that are from Canadian schools? Is that a thing?
You know, you raise a good question. I have not as of yet seen anything in terms of research that shows me the history of Canadian samplers the same way that I see, say, with the Ackworth Group or the Bristol samplers that you've been talking about, or the schools that I've recently learned about out of the Portsmouth area or any area within the U.S. I think part of that is about development. It's about how many people are within a particular area, meaning what is the population size, but they are definitely here, and they do tell particular stories, but the history of them, I'm not sure if it's as far researched. It's one of those things that to me is so exciting that's opening up in front of me, because it's there as an area to research, but it's also something that, because of the amount of time that I now have not working in a corporate environment, I can then spend to try and answer that question a little better.
It's very easy to get Bristol samplers, European samplers, and the last conversation I had with Barbara Hudson talking about American samplers. I mean, there's a whole huge story to be told there, and has been told about American samplers. And I just got to believe that you'll discover that same thing with Canada, that there's at least some history and a collection of them to be had.
Well, it's one of the things that's forefront on my mind in terms of where I would like to take what I'm doing, is to be able to interpret Canadian samplers, and to be able to research them and tell their stories. One of the things that's hopefully going to happen in the next 2 weeks is that I will finally get my hands on a Canadian dated and place name sampler, which I don't have in my collection. I have four or five that have been framed here in Canada. The potential is they could be Canadian or they could be American, they could be European, but this one is dated to the 1840s, and it is named to Gananoque, which is a small city on the St. Lawrence between Quebec and Toronto. So I'm hoping that will open up this whole discussion for me and be able to give me an area where I can start to interpret from a Canadian perspective.
Yeah, that'll be fascinating to follow. I've not heard of anybody who's done anything with Canadian samplers. Have you, Vana?
No.
No. So that could be quite interesting. Yeah. Well, good luck. I hope it works out.
I hope it does, because this little girl, her father, if it turns out to be the person based on the preliminary research, the town hall in Gananoque belonged to this gentleman, and he was involved in the development of the St. Lawrence Seaway. He was involved in politics. He was involved in milling, which is right up my alley. When you go back to, you know, my job, it places it right in what I talk about on a daily basis for 5 or 6 months of the year. So I'm hopeful. I'm just trying to contain my excitement because I want it to come through. I don't want anything to kind of prevent me from getting this sampler.
Don't jinx it.
Exactly. Don't jinx it. Don't talk about it. You know, it possibly won't turn out, but I'm hoping that things turn out well and that I can be able to start talking from a Canadian perspective.
Okay, we'll move on to something else quickly.
Don't jinx it. Don't jinx
no.
it.
No, moving on. We didn't talk about it. That whole thing, working in the corporate world, so you worked a time at more conventional jobs before you ended up in Upper Canada Village. And did needlework continue through those years?
It did. And, you know, I always have talked about time or money. And there was a time in my life when I had very little time to stitch, but I had more money to collect. So I would go to retreats and I would go to my friend Anne's shop in Brighton, and I would, you know, we'd have this retreat and she'd bring all of her threads over, and I'd sit on the floor and I'd collect these threads. And eventually I got a full set of three different over dyes, and, you know, but I wasn't stitching much. And then the time came when corporate America at the time, which was in Canada, I left that world and there was more time. So then I started to use those materials. So there's been a wax and wane. There's been more stitching and less stitching, you know, over the period of time from when I first started to today.
Yeah. And now with your job, the way you have it now, I'm sure, yeah, it gives you a lot more time to explore and to stitch. And, it's a perfect fit if you even haul it along to work, isn't it?
It is. It's a seasonal thing. You know, I did find this year it was a bit more difficult in the summer because I was focused so much on just learning the job and the research required to interpret accurate period cooking. And a lot of the things that I would be looking to would be to some of your cooking, because there's not a lot of history here, written history in terms of recipes. Mm-hmm. So it meant less stitching. But the thing for me is, because of the nature of my job, I can't take my stitching into my job. I'm actually given projects to work on, and those are done within a historical context, where the things that I do them separate from that. So I could take it and do it on my lunch. I could take it in the morning or the evening. But as far as during the day, there's really no opportunity for me to stitch.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'd have it set up in the back room. Yep.
Yep.
I'll be back in 10 minutes. Yeah. So the whole sampler thing, you have a collection of samplers and reproducing them. Mm-hmm. What's your procedure there? I mean, you standard magnifier and count and use software to map them out?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Online software, magnifier on my computer desk, and usually I'll also have a needle, and I have a smaller magnifier that gives me a little bit better view of some of the smaller sampler areas. But yes, it's testing that through reproducing it. But starting off, it's done on computer.
Yeah. I'm always intrigued, and I get pretty much the same answer every time, but I like to ask it. The whole choice about what colors to use, is it for you mostly the backside colors, or do you like the older looks, you tend toward the front side?
I have to admit that's an area that I struggle with, because the samplers that I collect, I call them ragamuffins, and it's something I, you know, I know that there are other stitchers out there and other designers who will refer to that particular term, but my samplers are not perfect. They have areas of foxing, they have areas of color loss, they have holes, they have stitch loss. So one of the areas that I've struggled in and I'm trying to develop a sense of is what exactly am I going to do with some of these challenges, because there are significant loss in color. And the reason why I collect these samplers is because of the front of them rather than the back of them. So I don't think I can say I have a consistent approach as of yet. I tend to take a look at the sampler and go on that particular sample and make some judgmental decisions.
Yeah, see, that's an interesting part. And I've wondered that too, because a lot of these samplers are in amazing shape, but there's also a truckload of them that have been pretty well beat up. But you can't just toss those out because they're still a piece of history. But then you got a little interpretation you have to make to decide what to do with that. And that's got to be an interesting challenge.
It is an interesting, and it's a fantastic challenge, because I feel that those samplers deserve an opportunity to shine. And it takes more time. And I had shared a photo of you of some of my work, and I've shared it on my Instagram and Facebook pages, where, you know, just the starting of that process of selecting colors. And it's a very laborious process where, to be able to select those colors, I literally will sit down on a nice day like today, where the sun's shining in through multiple windows in my house, and I'll sit at the dining room table, and I will literally pull out my three lines of over-dyed floss, and I have full lines of each one, and I will pull out every possible iteration of color that I would potentially want to use front and back. And then they'll sit on my dining room table, and I'll slowly weed them down to a place where I feel like I've got a palette of colors that I want to choose from. And it may represent three or four choices for every single color. And then I start stitching, and then I may end up pulling work out 3, 4, 5, 7 times to get that perfect color.
Mm-hmm. And cotton is your choice?
Cotton is my choice at this point. I've been reserving those samplers done in silk till I feel like I'm ready to tackle them. And I just haven't felt that I'm there yet.
Okay. Yeah, so it's interesting using over dyes. Is there what is the preference there?
So my first go to is Gentle Arts. I will use Weeks, and I will use Classic Colorworks as well. I find that all of them represent some choices that give me the palette that I need. But predominantly, so far, it has been Gentle Arts in the reproductions.
Hmm. And they have nice colors, no doubt about that.
Yep. They do. They have fantastic colors, and they have a nice range that really represents what you see on the samplers, and not just the original colors, but these faded, kind of abused looking colors, as you said, where these samplers have lived their lives. They've really been treasured and loved, but they haven't been, protected, shall we say, and that they give that color that I'm looking for.
Yeah.
I would agree with that. As an over dye user, I would say that Gentle Arts does have the faded, old, drug through the mud look. You know what I mean? Rather than the other two. I agree with that. Not that anybody cares.
I'm just thinking if that's a good marketing line, drug through the mud.
Yeah. Gentle Arts, drug through the mud for you.
Yeah, they might want to work on that a little bit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, for me, it's and I think I've mentioned this before, when it comes to these samplers, that it's an interesting decision, at least in my mind, is do you go for that look, that drug through the mud, older, aged look, or do you take that same sampler and give it a fresh look, a new look in terms of what those bright colors would have been at the time, as close as you can make them, and maybe a linen that's a little closer to white or off-white. I think that's an interesting discussion and decision to make in terms of how any of us want our reproductions to look. And I know a lot of people like to have that old look.
And it's something that I haven't been as as much a part of these conversations. I've kind of been outside of it to a certain degree. And I hear these conversations, and I, because of the presentations that I do and where I work, and there's always this conversation that sometimes happens of how far do you take that reproduction? You know, how far do you go in making it look like it would have looked when it was stitched? And in some cases, you know, you can do that. And I know recently you did a presentation with Mike Parr, and he was talking about the production of gold. Because those materials are no longer available, or we don't produce them in that manner, an uneven weave, the way that they were produced, how far can you actually go in that production to be able to make it like it would have been in the original state? And that's the piece where I'm still evaluating that and trying to come up with what's the way that I want to do this? What is the way that I want to bring this to someone else to allow them to enjoy these samplers? And I think I'm taking it a sampler at a time and then making individual decisions. And one of the things that I want to hear more of is the perspective of other designers of how they approach that, and how they get to that place of making that decision.
Yeah. Well, but you know, your initial thought is a negative thing there, but to me, that's the art of it, is making those decisions and doing the, there's an interpretation there, and you know, how do I want to present this? How do I feel that it's best represented from its original? And so as a designer, then you get to do some interpretation and change the presentation to reflect what you feel about it. And you're the one doing the history research, so you kind of get a sense there too, I think. And, mm-hmm. You know, because it just, there's an element of art to it, at least in my mind.
I would absolutely agree. I would absolutely agree. And being true to what I have in front of me while still then bringing it back to life is part of that artistic part.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I think that you've done, I've followed Leanne for a long time because she had a blog, and then I know and am kind of friendly with a lot of the people that she stitches with in Canada. And so I've followed her on Facebook and Instagram all along. And I think, Leanne, that you've done a beautiful job in your reproducing of the samplers that you've done so far to date. The one that I truly love with all my heart is your first one, the Marianne Raywood. I love that. But then there's one, and forgive me, I don't know what the name of it is, but it's like got fruits of baskets and maybe like parrots or something, and very brightly colored. And it's recent, I think.
Mary White.
Yeah. That one is totally, you can see that it's almost matched perfectly, in my opinion. When I looked at that, I was shocked at how well, you know, the conversion was, or how you did it. And I really think that is a, how you approach it, even though that you say that you're unsure about what your technique is, in my mind, you're doing justice to the samplers that you purchased and the ones that you've reproduced. In my opinion, I think that they're beautifully done.
Well, thank you. That's much appreciated. Marianne, or Mary White, to me was a relatively easy one to make decisions on, because there wasn't a lot of color loss front to back. Mm-hmm. And she was just a wonderful stitch. And I think the uncertainty comes in, because I started out with a sampler that right now is kind of taking a nap. And she's been put to bed because we're not playing well together. And I talk about it. I have an upcoming release called Elfrida Lewis, and I was struggling with the same thing for a long time with Elfrida, where I would pick a color and it wasn't right, and I take it out, and I pick a color and I put another one in and I take it out. And I came back to something that my art teachers told me in high school. I had two people that were really instrumental. And I, Miss Torney, who I talked about, who was the first person that I ever saw cross stitching, and Karen Peppercorn, who was a teacher of this kind of immersive year and a half fine arts program where I did figure drawing and, you know, oil painting and did everything. And I had this same challenge when I was in high school, when I was trying to study fine art and I was developing portraiture techniques and really the fine art side of who I am, is that I'm not sure if you've ever experienced this, but you get too close to a work and all of a sudden you hate it. You can't see it. You can't appreciate it. You can't evaluate it. And that's really that idea of, you know, I've got something up at my nose. I've got to get out of my own way, that, you know, a couple of these samplers have really taught me. And to your point of, you know, how am I going to interpret these? Now I've come to a place where, you know, Mary White was one and now Fanny Crompton, which I'm working on at the moment. I'm not in that place as much where I'm kind of questioning what I'm doing. I'm just doing it. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to see where it takes me. And I'm going to let my needle lead me, and I'm going to let the colors lead me. And I'm not going to be spending so much time double questioning my decisions of just letting it run.
Right. And I think trusting your gut when you're an artist, and that's what you are when you're doing these interpretations of samplers, is the way you should go. You know what I mean? A lot of times when I mean, I'm not an artist, but when I finish stuff, a lot of times I think, I should have done it this way. And that's how I had thought about doing it the first time. Then I thought, no, I'm not going to do it. You know what I mean? And I think, yep, a lot of times if you just go with your gut, even though you're a little unsure about it, 9 times out of 10, it's going to turn out the best way.
Yep. Yep.
What are the mechanics when you're doing that? Are you sitting there with, obviously you're with a magnifier and you're putting together a chart, but when it comes to these colors, do you have the model that you're working on, and then do you have a doodle cloth that you're testing things on before you actually stitch them into the model? What is the mechanics of making that all happen?
So in terms of, I think the way that I would answer that, Gary, is progression. I will get a sampler and I'll start thinking about it. It comes into my collection, then I decide I'm going to chart it. I don't sit down with any threads. I literally sit down at my computer with the sampler in front of me, and then I start to chart it. And I just use the colors that are on there that look kind of right. I'm not even paying attention. I'm just looking at values on it. Does this bird at the top, this blue at the top, look the same as this blue at the bottom? And then I just chart everything together. Then I go, and I usually go to a local needle workshop. For me, local needle workshops means I need to travel 3 hours one way or 3 hours another way to kind of fondle fabrics and make a decision. And that's what I do. So I usually end up at in Syracuse, 3 hours to the north, or to the south, excuse me. And I then choose my fabric. Then I come back, pick all those colors, and then I start stitching. And I start choosing colors, and then on my pattern that I've printed from my software, I start to make adjustments. Have I made a mistake somewhere in my charting? Have I changed a color completely? And then I will go back to the computer after I've stitched. Unless I've made a mistake I have to fix, like I've got right now on an area of Fanny Crompton, I've made a mistake in one of the baskets. I've got to fix that, because I know if I don't fix it, I'm going to make a mistake in my model. Then I will, when I'm finished my model, I'll go back in and make my edits in my pattern, and then I'll print it. Mm. So I'm literally not making any decisions until I'm physically stitching. And even as I'm physically stitching, I'm changing those decisions.
So it is very fluid all the way through then.
The one that's on timeout right now, she's in bed. She's had 7 color corrections in just one color. And there's probably 4 or 5 colors in there that I've done the same way. But she's one of the ones that's in the worst shape. So then she requires a lot more attention and a lot more decision-making. And to your point, Vaughn, it was about trusting my gut. And I knew I wasn't there, and I knew what I was doing. I just knew I needed to get on to something else where I could get that sense of comfort.
Right.
It's interesting. How many times have we talked to reproduction sampler people, and I can hear it in you that you develop a kinship and a connection with the sampler that's beyond just simply charting.
So true.
Yeah. Yeah.
But don't you feel that as a stitcher, don't you feel like that when you're stitching a reproduction, Gary?
Oh yes. Oh yeah. Yeah.
I mean, like I feel that when I stitch Sarah B, you know what I mean? Or any of them that I've stitched, it's like, oh, I love this. How can I finish it? You know what I mean? It makes me sad almost for some of them. Some of them I'm ready to finish, but I can understand how you would, you know, like dissecting it the way Leanne and others do to reproduce. How could you not like almost like cry when you're done with it. You know what I mean? That's how I would feel, but I'm mushy that way, I guess.
Well, and the thing is that, you know, when the stitching's done, isn't done. So I tend to carry them a little bit longer. It's not like I'm giving up an 8-year-old. I feel like I'm almost giving up the 16-year-old when the pattern goes out the door. Like, it's like, okay, it's time for you to go out in life now. You've got everything that I can possibly ever give you. Now you've got to live your own life now.
Oh, I understand that. I mean, I do. I really do.
Yeah. But they are, like, to me, they're, and maybe it's that historical context, you know, that I go back to, is imagining and thinking of the stories of a little girl who maybe doesn't have the money. She gets taken under the wing of someone who is a teacher. They gift her with silk threads, and she's already in a position where maybe her life is limited because of where her family is, but this lady gives her an opportunity. And I imagine stories, and maybe that's, you know, I just like storytelling, but I come up with it's almost like there's a story behind there, and I don't necessarily know what it is, but that's enticing to me in terms of being able to give them an opportunity to shine, because they're the ones that typically get overlooked. And it's usually the comment I get from a lot of people, which I understand, is that it's too bad that they're in such bad condition. And for me, that's the very thing that drives me to find them, is to, you know, be able to then appreciate them from what they are and maybe give them a new dress.
Yeah.
See, and I admire that, because that's, like I said, there's an awful lot of samplers that need some serious love, and to take those and put them on their feet again, and for people to be able to stitch them, I think is just a real neat, different aspect and contribution to the overall hobby.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's a driving addiction, going back to the beginning of our conversation of finding something and then, you know, seeing it and not being able to read it, and then getting it home and trying to figure out, what is this actually saying? And, you know, what is this verse, and where does this verse come from? And what could have possibly been part of their, you know, religious background or their cultural background that could have made them say this? Or was this part of that history that all comes into it?
And your workspace, and I want to be sure and explore this a little bit. Your workspace, you live in a one-room schoolhouse. That's where the name of your company comes from?
It is. So I live in what was a one-room schoolhouse built in 1897. It originally had 16-foot ceilings. It now has an upstairs and a downstairs with 3 bedrooms. So my stitching space, again, long-suffering husband come into the picture here. We have 2 bedrooms that are my stitching space, my living room, my dining room, stuff in the basement. Yeah, my stitching stuff is everywhere. Charting is upstairs in one room, which is where I am today, in my kind of computer room. I have another room, which is more kind of production and where all my patterns are, and my library of books and my needlework small antique collection, that kind of stuff. All the antique addiction that kind of flows out from these samplers is there. And then I stitch downstairs, and that's on the couch.
One of these days, we're going to form the Fiber Talk Long Suffering Husband Club.
Well, I think it should be the Long Suffering Husband and Wife Club, because Marga does an awful lot of suffering for you too.
Yeah. She certainly would fit in that club, no doubt about it. Yeah,
she sure does.
Yeah. That's interesting. Taking a one-room schoolhouse and converting it to a home. Boy, that must have been fun.
Well, my husband and I used to joke that the house, I came after the house, that my husband had the house before I met him 23 years ago. And we used to joke that we needed to have shares in Home Depot, because that was our Friday night date for, I don't know, 15, almost 20 years. And it was a long journey. And I think he underestimated the breadth of this project, and I, of course, had all kinds of ideas of clawfoot bathtubs and pedestal sinks and great big sinks, and anyway, it just took on a life of its own, and now we're at a point where it's mostly done.
Oh, jeez.
Well, there's some trim missing, and now we're at the point where, because we've done all this work and we spent so many years doing it, and we did it to look to a particular period, that it needs maintenance.
Yeah.
So Yep.
And then you own a church next door, is that?
I do.
You see, this is the personal life is equally fascinating. See, well,
Yeah.
okay,
Well,
gotta know, what are you doing with the church?
okay. So, husband moves into the house, and next door is a what was called the music hall. It had originally been a church. It was a Baptist church, Methodist church. I apologize. I cannot get the two mixed up, and I can never remember which one it is. But they had built it originally, and then they built a much larger church in a little town about 5 minutes from here. And so they just used it as kind of a community organization. People could come and go. And we had thought for a long time, you know, we should ask if that who owns it, what the situation is, and we'd actually found out that this church still owned it. And then one day I came home when I was again back in a time when I was working in corporate America, and I came home and there was this sign on the lawn for sale. And it was, we're nobody's buying this place because it's literally beside ours. We have just about an acre on our schoolhouse property, and this is about a third of an acre. So smack dab beside us is this other property. So journey happens. We end up buying this thing, and now it's my husband's workshop. He used it to for 4 years to build a kitchen that we found out of Syracuse, New York, to renovate it to install in our house, and a bowling alley that comes out of Kentucky as my countertop. So that's how it started being used, and now it's used for his antique and my antique car. So the story just goes on and on and on.
I guess it does. Yeah, and I had to ask about, I wanted to make sure to ask about those antique cars because those look pretty neat.
They are. My husband had Land Rovers when he was a teenager. He had them by himself, and then he bought a couple with his cousin, and he loved to wrench on them, and then he didn't have them. And about 10 years ago, he bought his first one. It's a 1957 Series 1 Land Rover, so it looks like an old Willys Jeep. And a lot of the development of that is based on your Willys Jeep that would have been used during the Second World War. And then he has a 1981, but this 1980 Land Rover was actually used as part of the British Army of the Rhine. It was in Germany for very many years, and it ended up in Canada, and he ended up buying it.
And what's your antique car?
Mine is a 1961 Triumph TR3A. I've just had it about a month. We got about four drives in it, so I'm just itching for the winter to be over.
Oh man. Oh, that there's the gem right there.
It is. I've always loved driving, but my husband's interest is cars, and then we'd start to go to these car shows, and I'd look at them, and it was supposed to be a Mini, and because I drive a Mini every day, I have a new one, and I wanted an old one, and then this thing came up this fall, and I thought, ah, oh, I'm compromising. I shouldn't buy this thing. No. And then it was like, no, that's not compromising. It's coming home. And it did. Doesn't take up much space, thankfully. It is a quite a small car, so I'm not invading his space over there. Back to your question of what is this building for? That's his space, and then it's compensation for me taking over the rest of the house with my stitching stuff.
There you go. And now we're even.
You've got it.
Oh boy, that car. There you go. That's the one right there.
It's a beauty.
So let's you've got three published patterns: Above the Sky, Heats of Flutter, and Granny's Garden. Those are the three that are out there.
They are. So Hearts of Flutter and Granny's Garden and hopefully another one. I'm hoping in the next couple of weeks, Alfreda Lewis is coming out, and then there's a few others that hopefully by Christmas will also come on the market.
So two Granny's Gardens, are these reproductions or are they your own creation?
They're a hybrid. What they are is they're memories of my childhood that are based on, that come from the idea of my granny, who would be my great grandmother, of her garden and stories that come from my childhood. You know, the first one was about flowers that were literally in my granny's garden growing up. The second one, which is in the apple orchard, is about stories that come from apples and apple orchards and visiting apples and picking apples that involve my grandparents and my mom and my sister and a whole variety of people. So the design and the ideas behind them come from me, but the motifs are actually direct transfers from my sampler collection.
Oh, okay.
So okay. Then I come up with a design that kind of speaks to that idea that I have, but I'm doing it within the context of the historic sampler.
That sounds like fun.
It is.
Yeah.
I get to play, and then I get to put that little question, as I talked about before, behind me of how should I do this to fully the pages open. What do I want to explore? What idea do I want to explore? Everything then really just comes from me, but I'm putting it in a historical context by using those motifs from samplers that I own.
Yeah. Well, that's fun. All right. So, and we know that Mary White's in trouble. She's, yeah. Yeah, she'll be grounded for a couple of months. But then on your Facebook page, it looks like Fanny Crompton is coming right along then.
Yeah, so Mary White, just to correct, is actually not the one that's on timeout. I don't think I've shown any pictures of the one that's on timeout. I haven't been working on her.
Ooh, you're really mad at her then.
Oh, yeah, I haven't worked on her in probably 2 years. She's kind of sitting there. I've got a couple people that keep saying, Leanne, we really like her. Can you please finish her? And I will. But Mary White is actually out at the Framers getting stretched. And then she's going to come home. My husband repurposes antique frames for me so that I don't actually get the framer to frame my needlework. They just stretch it for me. And then he makes my frames. So Mary White is coming home to be framed. And then Fanny Crompton, she is just buzzing right along. I anticipate a finish hopefully within the next few days. Like she's just, I don't know. I think it's listening to podcasts, which I just discovered in the last week or so, is just making me, I don't know, my needle's on fire.
Yep. Got to have something to occupy that other side of the brain. Yep.
Yeah, that's usually period dramas, but the problem is I spend too much time watching them and not stitching. Again, that history thing, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's obviously in your genes there, yes.
Somewhere.
Yep. Yep. Well, Leanne, this has been a treat. Thank you so much for taking time. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm honored that you asked me.
And we learned all kinds of things. Oh, man, I can see a picture of that triumph. Wow. Yep. And I'll be sending you all the complaints from the Baptists and the Methodists. I'll just send those right on to you. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. You probably should, because I should know the difference. I should understand the history of a building that I own. I know it for my schoolhouse, but that one I just don't.
Yep. Well, they'll set you straight, both of them.
Oh, I'm sure they will, and they should, because there's always something to be learned.
That's right. All right, Leanne, thanks so much for doing it. Thanks to The Attic for sponsoring us.
Thank you.